Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have back in the studio with us once again, Jim Kaler. He is a professor emeritus of astronomy at University of Illinois. He has been with us many times before to talk about what you can see in the sky at various times of the year. He's written for many magazines. He was consultant for Time Life Books on their Voyage Through the Universe series. He has authored a number of books. I want to name a few. The Ever-Changing Sky, The Cambridge Encyclopedia of Stars, also two textbooks, The Little Book of Stars, The 100 Greatest Stars. He has two websites, Skylights, and that provides weekly information on what you can see in the sky, and also Stars, which features the Star of the Week. And he has off and on over the years here been on the program to talk a little bit about what you can see in the sky. And he's also open to questions that have to do with astronomy. So all you need to do, if you'd like to call in, is, well, call in. The number 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long distance call, use that number, we'll pay for it. And you can even send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So any point here, you got questions, you give us a call. Hey, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
For being here. We appreciate it. And glad to have you back. I think we got you there now.
Yeah, we're on. Talking into a blank here for a minute. Yeah.
So, well, let's start out and talk about what you can see in the sky this time of year.
Jupiter.
Jupiter has been really beautiful for quite a while now.
An article in the on a website recently about a fella in England who saw Jupiter rising, thought it was a flare from a distressed ship, and they called out helicopters and the British Coast Guard
Seriously?
To find out it was Jupiter rising. That's almost as good as the guy who recently saw the moon overhead and called the police wondering what that thing was.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm not
I don't believe
this up.
That.
I'm
I
not,
cannot
you
believe
can't,
that.
You can't make this stuff up.
What that thing was. The first time he'd ever seen it? That's very strange. Okay. Anyway, so Jupiter has been really spectacular and very, very beautiful.
Yeah,
and it's like due east pretty much, or a little bit
it,
off.
It
of
rises just before sunset now, and you can see it pretty much to the south, very high by the time you go to bed. Just mm-hmm. beautiful. Mm-hmm. Fourth brightest object in the sky after the sun, moon, and Venus, which you'll be seeing coming up in the southwestern sky. That'll dominate the sky in very late December, and next year it'll be spectacular. It'll bring in the UFO calls like crazy.
So what? This just has to do with the positions these things have
periodically?
Yeah, the
relative position of the planet and the Earth. They all go around in different speeds and different path lengths, and they're constantly shifting relative to each other. And you can see Mars very nicely now. If you look out around 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, look up in the east, and you'll see two bright star-like objects. The reddish one is Mars. The bluish one is the star Regulus. They're fairly close together right now. Mars is a little bit to the east of the star.
And you can genuinely tell Mars because it does have that
color.
Yeah,
it does have some color to it. It's kind of you get into profound arguments with people over what the color actually is. My eyes see it as kind of an orange-red, actually. Others see it as yellow-orange, and it's not worth the argument, but it's redder than the stars around it. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's to me. It does look kind of orange. I guess.
Yeah.
It's easy to pick it out.
Hence
when
the
you
name
see
Mars after the god of war, blood red, and which it isn't, but it's the reddest of all the planets, of course. And it turns out the red color is coming from iron oxide in the soil. It's rusty.
Mm-hmm. So we've got some planets. Jupiter, definitely, it's been around for a while, and soon Venus, and next year would be particularly
good
for Venus?
Well, after the first of the year, it'll really pick up steam, and you'll see it over in the southwest moving into the western sky, and it'll be very bright, much brighter than Jupiter. You believe me, you can't miss it. You'll mistake it for a plane with its headlights coming at you, landing at Willard or something like that.
Mm. I do remember a few years ago really being struck by Venus and how big and bright and spectacular it was, and that it would seem to me that at the time it was rising not that long after sunset, and it was in the south.
And then it sets very quickly after
west,
sunset.
I guess.
And it'll be with us for a good part of next year.
Yeah. It was the biggest, brightest I ever remember having seen.
When it's near its brightest, it can be seen in full daylight. You can see it in the blue sky. I've seen it a number of times that way. And it'll cast shadows. If you're out in the country and you got, and after Venus gets up pretty high, after twilight's over with, going out in the woods or something, you take a look and see eerie shadows cast by its light. It's quite beautiful.
Oh, that's spectacular. I was interested. I was just noodling around looking for some things to talk about, and actually it came across a photograph of Venus. And you, I think of Venus as being, well, it's this planet that has this cloudy atmosphere all around it. But this was a photograph that was showing you the temperatures on the surface of Venus, and it made it look like a boiling molten
About 900 degrees Fahrenheit.
Thing.
It's not a pleasant place to live. The Soviets landed a couple of two or three or four packages on the surface of the planet, and I think they survived the pressures 100 times that of the Earth's atmosphere. And it just destroyed the spacecraft. They only lived about half an hour on the surface. It's a greenhouse effect gone nuts because it's all 100 atmospheric pressures and 96% carbon dioxide. All the carbon's in the air rather than in the ground. I don't think the Venusians did it. there's not that many of them.
Venusian climate change?
No.
Okay.
Well, yeah, okay. Climate change, probably. Because there's speculation that it might once have had an ocean, but the volcanism has wiped out all early traces of anything on the planet. Mm-hmm. So we'll probably never know.
Okay. So besides the planets that you can see, the naked eye planets that you can see, what else is good to see this time?
Well, we got an eclipse coming up, an eclipse of the moon, but you're going to have to be doggone dedicated to see it. It's just about, for those of us in central Illinois, it'll be about... It's about the time of moonset, so you got to look at 6-7 o'clock in the morning just to get a really good horizon. If you live farther west, and for all our listeners on the west coast, you'll get a pretty good view of it in the early morning hours.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
it'll be a few years before we get another one around here. Mm-hmm. So,
and stars? What are the stars?
Well, you can find Orion is beautiful. Now you look around 10 or 11 o'clock at night off in the southwest, and you see this beautiful big 7-star pattern of Orion. And the upper left-hand star, Betelgeuse, is about the color of Mars. It'll appear reddish. You can really tell the difference in the color. And what really stands out is the famous Orion belt, these three stars right in a row, which the ancient Arabs called the string of pearls. And it was really apt. It just looks like pearls on a string. And down and to the left of it, you'll see Sirius rising, the brightest star in the sky. It won't rival Jupiter, but the planets don't twinkle very much. They just sort of sit there and stare at you because they're disks. They're not really point sources, whereas Sirius is the champion twinkler of the sky. It's really a lovely sight.
So this, you know, we've talked about this before, and how it is that you tell the difference between a star and a planet, that the stars twinkle and the planets don't. And is that really the bottom line, is that the stars actually give off light, and the planets, all they're doing is they're just reflecting
it? No, it's not that. The star, to the human eye, a star is a point. And the starlight passes, to get to your eye, has to pass through variable layers in the atmosphere that are shifting around by winds and so on. And the image jumps back and forth, gets focused and defocused, changes color and brightness. Mm-hmm. And a planet is a disk, and each point on the planet's surface will twinkle just like a star. But the point on the east side of the planet will twinkle at a different pace than the point on the west side of the planet, and the two tend to cancel each other. And you wind up with a fairly steady light, even though you can't see the planet as a disk. It shows you that the twinkling is on a very small scale. Hmm. Planets will twinkle, but you see Venus do it once in a while, but it's kind of a little flash. It doesn't do it very much. The best way to learn planets, of course, is to learn your constellations, and then know if it ain't a star, it's a planet. And you can follow the motion. Mars is moving like crazy to the east relative to the background. You can see it over only a few days.
Okay. Well, let me just say real quick, Jim Kaler's our guest. He's a professor emeritus of astronomy at the University of Illinois, and has been on the program before many times to talk about what you can see in the sky at various times of the year. And if you have questions about that, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send an email if you'd like to send your question along that way, and that's will-talk, info@illinois.edu. So anything else in the sky you'd like to direct our attention to?
Well, you can look overhead and see Cassiopeia very nicely. It's the, if you're, again, in a dark sky, you've got, it's this sort of W, upside down W shape. Now, why they don't call it an M, well, it's because it's got splayed sides on it. It looks more like an upside down W. Part of the Andromeda myth, and really quite an attractive constellation. The farthest northerly position of the Milky Way, and the winter Milky, you can see if, again, it's the dark sky syndrome. You got to be out in the country to see a lot of this stuff. That's why the planets are so nice. You can see them from Champaign-Urbana with all the bright lights. But if you're out in the country, you can still see some remnants of the Milky Way over in the north. West, but the winter Milky Way is very faint. It runs down to the left of Orion, down through Canis Major where Sirius is, and it's just faint and kind of ghostly looking. The best time to see it, of course, is in the evening, is early August. And come March and April, you'll see it rising in the east in the early morning hours.
Yeah. I think one of the great things that now we have, technologically speaking, is that there are a lot of good astronomy computer applications, and I know, for example, for those people who have tablets now, there are a number of things where you can take your tablet outside, and it knows what direction you're facing.
Yeah, it picks up GPS and knows your latitude, longitude.
It knows where you are, knows whether you're facing north, south, whatever it is.
You can point it up to the sky, and it'll overlay the constellation.
And it'll overlay, and that's
just so cool.
The most fabulous thing, because you can look up and you can say, oh, that's what I am seeing, and it will tell you what.
Back when I was a boy, back yes. when you walked uphill to school through 6 feet of snow in each direction, you picked up one star at a time. I discovered the Big Dipper, and then you used the Big Dipper to locate various other stars and so on. So it's the old-fashioned way. The old ways are the best ways, right? But not really anymore. It's beautiful the way you can get these aids to pick out the stars. And then there's an aid to real learning, too.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's going to get, one would hope that would get a lot of people excited about astronomy, little ones particularly, because there's star charts and things like that existed before, but to have it be able to do that that's something.
That's part of the science, what is, I guess, left of the scientific beauty of constellations. They charm people, and they get the kids out and people out to see it, and then they begin interested in the stars and the things that make up the constellations, and before you know it, you're an amateur astronomer. Before you know it, you're a professional astronomer. Before you know it, you're an emeritus professional astronomer.
Well, probably not everybody follows that path, but a few people we know. I followed that path. Hey, we have a caller here, someone who is in Sycamore, up in the northwestern part of the state. Why don't we talk with them on our line 4, toll-free line right here. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in knowing about the Large Binocular Telescope that I've heard about, and I'm curious to know how it's used and why it's useful for professional astronomers, which who I understand nowadays don't ever look through their telescopes. They use imaging devices and various scientific instruments to break apart the light and study it through their telescopes. And for that, I think you only need one optical system. So what do they use the Large Binocular Telescope for?
I'm not all that familiar with it, but for one thing, you can look at the sky in two different wavelengths at the same time, two different colors at the same time. So you get two for the price of one, basically, and that's probably the primary purpose, although I'm sure there are others that I can't come up with at the moment. It's not quite true that astronomers don't look through the telescopes, but you have to sneak an eyepiece into it to do it. They don't like you to do it because it costs too much to run the darn things. But I've done it a few times, and it's kind of fun, but you do it at twilight, and you don't let anybody else know about it.
Yeah, I can see that. And, of course, using binocular systems for looking through things would be probably quite spectacular. I know
there are available, and most amateurs make their own binocular telescopes. You can get binocular eyepieces in which you can look through the telescope with two eyes at the same time, and the view is pretty good. And a few amateurs have pulled off making actual binocular telescopes. Which are very tricky to make into a line and a collimate and so on. But the view, again, would be very, very good. Technologically, I'd have to look up to see what the LBT, which is lettuce, bacon, and tomato, is when you think about it, actually is used for, but I think the primary purpose is looking at the sky in two colors at the same time, or for doing two entirely different things. I'm coming on to it. You could do photometry with one telescope and do spectroscopy with the other, or the same field of view at the same time, looking for ephemeral objects.
Okay, very interesting. Well, thank you very much.
All right, very good. Thank you. On to another caller here, Tohoat. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Is there a formula for calculating the sun's angle from the horizon during the summer and winter solstices?
Yeah. You could write it. It's a fairly simple spherical trigonometry formula that you could.
Okay.
I'm not sure where you could find it. I think you can. I hate to say this, but I think you can find most of that in my book, The Ever-Changing Sky. There's a trig section in the back that I think tells you how you can do that sort of thing, or at least you can get started on the spherical trig and the spherical triangles necessary to calculate it. You need to know the your longitude, of course, and what the default is relative to standard times and so on.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I've got in that book, I've got a bunch of graphs that actually give you the local times.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
They're also the actual times of at different times of the year are given by as tables in the Astronomical Almanac, which is a publication of the U.S. Naval Observatory and Her Majesty's Hydrographic Office, and is available in it's available in the UVI libraries, I know, and available from the U.S. Government Printing Office for $40 or something like that.
Is there a website that might have it too?
Yeah, actually, you can get it calculated through the U.S. Naval Observatory. Put in sunrise and sunset and USNO, and it should come up. Something should come up for you.
Okay.
Naval Observatory is in charge of all of this in the country. They're not in charge of sunrise and sunset. They're in charge of calculating.
Sure. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, thank you. Other questions are welcome. Our guest is Jim Kaler. He's an emeritus professor of astronomy here at the U of I, and we're talking about what you can see in the sky. And you have questions about that or about astronomy, astronomical things, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I was just reading, again, the suggestion that if people were interested in starting to do a little astronomy as amateurs, that and the mention of binoculars made me think about this. That's actually recommended that maybe people, instead of going out and buying a telescope, that a good pair of binoculars, provided you've got something to hold them
either
steady,
or you
will
now get good image stabilized binoculars. Where if your handshake, like the systems in modern SLR cameras. Where if your hands shake and everybody's hands shake to some degree, it'll stabilize the image. And I don't have them, unfortunately, so mine tend to zip around. I got a pair of 16 by 80s at home, and they're heavy and hard to hold, so they worry out pretty quickly. But if you use a tripod and image-stabilized binoculars, which are fairly expensive, but they can give you a spectacular view of the sky, wide-angle view of the sky. You can see all sort of manner of things with them.
Yeah.
Put them on Jupiter. In fact, you just take a pair of horse racing glasses and put them on Jupiter. You can see sometimes the little spots next to it. You can pick out the Galilean satellites, just binoculars.
Okay,
rings of Saturn won't come, but then Saturn's visible as an early morning object now anyway. It's hard to find.
Yeah. So if that's something people are maybe thinking about experimenting with, that's something that not only can you use to look at the sky, but you can do bird watching, or you know, there are a lot of other things that you can do with them.
It's a good starting system. And if anybody's interested, there are a number of mail order houses around the country where you can buy small telescopes. You know, you can get started with a 60 millimeter lens, 80 millimeter, or get a small reflecting telescope, 4-inch, something like that. Start small. Don't get anything huge to start with.
Yeah.
And first thing you do is take if it comes equipped with a solar filter, take it, find the nearest fire hydrant that you can, and throw it at the fire hydrant as hard as you can. So you're never tempted to use a solar filter on a telescope. Very dangerous, unless you know really what you're doing.
Because it would do serious damage to your eyes.
Yeah. Cheap ones can break, and that's not a good idea. We show students things through the 12-inch telescope on the campus, but we're using professionally made filters that are reliable.
And for people who'd like to have that experience of looking through a big telescope, there are periodically times when you open up the
first astronomy Friday,
for that?
First Friday of every month, the U of I Astronomy Club runs open houses at the observatory. Okay. During the academic year, of course.
Okay. So coming up soon, there will be one. And now this is the time of year, I suppose, that you get better viewing if it's the humidity is lower.
Yeah. That's certainly true of us here in the Midwest, not true elsewhere in the country necessarily, but the humidity is down and the air seems clearer. And the winter stars are spectacularly bright anyway, so it gives you some kind of the illusion as well of clarity.
Okay, good. Well, let's talk with somebody else here. Monticello, Indiana, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Yes, I called in a few years ago with the same question, and I didn't really catch the answer or get it correct. But during the day, sometimes you can see the, you know, obviously the sun, and then across the sky you'll see the moon, but it won't be a full moon. And you, I mean, why is that, that you can, during the day, see the moon, but it's like a crescent of a moon? I mean, why can you not see the whole moon?
What confuses people, I think, most about the phases of the moon is that the sky looks like it's a sphere in two dimensions, and the sun looks the same distance as the moon, whereas really the sun is 400 times farther away. And the moon is a small body going around the Earth, and what you're seeing is different illuminated daytime portions of the moon. Moon goes, any point on the moon goes through day and night every month. And if the moon is in between us and the sun, you're looking at the nighttime side because the daytime illuminated daytime side is facing away from us, and you can't see it. That's called new moon. Shift the moon a little bit around in the orbit, and you begin to see a little glimmer of the daytime side, which is the crescent moon, which will set shortly after the sun because it hasn't moved very far. You move it 90 degrees around the Earth, a quarter of a turn, and you can see half the daytime, half the nighttime. And it's still going to be visible in the daytime because it sets about a quarter of a day after the sun. And you move it farther, 180 degrees, and you got full moon. And as the sun goes down, the moon comes up. The two are opposite each other, and then they reverse. Then the whole thing, picture reverses, goes around in reverse. That make sense?
The caller rang off, so I hope so.
Well,
if he wants
so.
To follow up, he'll come back.
Yeah,
so,
it's confusing because the two look at the same distance, and it doesn't make sense to the eye-brain combination that there should be phases, whereas if you sort of begin thinking of the sun as much farther away than the moon, it begins to make some geometrical sense to you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And other questions are welcome by phone, by email. You can send us email will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can call us 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number, toll-free 800-222-9455. I was going to ask you, and I don't know if this is too complicated, but not very long ago, I had a conversation here on the program with Deva Sobel, who's a science writer. And she has just fairly recently had written a book about Copernicus.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of it.
And we just reran it because I was kind of thinking about it. And the sort of the whole jumping off point for the thing is that here, Copernicus, here was this guy who at a time when most people argued that the Earth was at the center, at least the center of the solar system, and everything was going around it. He said, no, no, no. The sun is at the center, and we and the other planets are going around the sun.
Yeah, the idea is actually ancient. It goes back, I think, to Aristarchus in B.C. times. But he wasn't, of course, believed. And we're all at the center of our own personal universe, like I said. So I suppose the Earth has to be. The Earth is where we all exist, so to the ancient mind, it had to be at the center of everything.
Well, it seemed here we were standing here. It doesn't feel to us like we're moving. We look, everything
well,
else is moving.
That was the original argument. How could we be moving? We'd feel you jump up in the air, and the Earth would turn underneath you. I used to think that as a kid, so I tried jumping up in the air, and I just landed back at the same place where I jumped from. And I learned later that it's because everything's going around at the same speed.
Mm-hmm. Well, the question is, why was it that I'm sure he probably was not the only one, but why, what was it that led him to ask this question? Wait a minute, to come up with this other way.
The ancient problem that you're dealing with the planets is that they move erratically. If you follow Mars, for example, it's been zipping along eastward, following as it goes counterclockwise around its own orbit, a little bit slower than the Earth. It's been moving eastward. Passed through Gemini and then Cancer. It's now in Leo. But it's if you keep your eye on it, it's slowing down in its motion, and it will eventually stop, and then it reverses itself. It goes backwards for a while. It's called retrograde motion. And Ptolemy and the ancients prior to him constructed sort of elaborate systems where planets were on separate orbits that kind of epicycles that rode around in circular orbits around the Earth. First application of mathematical Fourier series, I think it's called. And they explained it that way without any kind of physical. I mean, nobody knew what planets were, so I suppose it's perfectly logical that they could do that. But it makes much more sense if the sun is at the center of the solar system and everything goes around the sun, and then the backward motion of Mars is just the Earth passing between us and the planet. So it looks like it's going backwards. It's not really going backwards. And that's sort of the tip-off that the sun is at the center. And I suppose that was one of the things that tipped Copernicus off to it, so too.
That all these astronomers had come up with these sort of tortured explanations to try to explain why the planets did these crazy things.
It was just simpler that way.
And then he said, well, wait a minute. If you put the sun at the center, then suddenly everything made sense.
Makes perfect sense. But it wasn't necessarily true, but it made more sense for predicting the positions of planets for astrological purposes, for example. And then Galileo and others eventually showed it made more physical sense, too, because when he looked at Venus and saw that Venus went through phases just like the moon, the only way you can really do that and have the moon go through all its set of phases is to have the sun at the center.
Yeah.
Unless you get even more tortured with your systems.
And it's also interesting that the Copernicus story is that essentially the reason that Copernicus didn't get in trouble and Galileo did is that Copernicus for a long time he didn't talk about it. He kept it pretty much to himself.
Which was probably a good idea at the time because was a fellow named Bruno who came up with some of the same idea wound up being burned at the stake for his efforts. Didn't help that he was apparently, from what history I've read, a sort of a political rabble-rouser, and they use it as an excuse. But still, he probably would have gotten himself in trouble eventually, as Galileo did.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of focus is Jim Kaler. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy at University of Illinois. We're talking about what you can see in the sky at this time of year. We will talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Natural Gourmet. Natural Gourmet is a natural food store specializing in vitamin supplements, homeopathic remedies, and organic foods. Located at the Shops of Knollwood, their restaurant features Thai-influenced foods for eat-in or carry-out.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you here. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We got 10 different topics for you every week. In hour two of the show today, Dr. Suzanne Troopen will be here taking questions on women's health. Tomorrow morning at 10, we will talk with Daniel Solove. He is a professor of law at the George Washington University Law School, and we will be talking about a book that he has written that's titled Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. And also tomorrow we'll talk about things that are in the sky, but we'll talk about airlines and air travel. And our guest will be Patrick Smith. He is a pilot, an airline pilot, a commercial pilot. He's also an air travel columnist for Salon.com and has his own site, which is AskThePilot.com, and we'll talk about air travel. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon, 10 different topics for you every week, and we welcome your questions and comments. And our guest this hour of Focus is Jim Kaler. He's Emeritus Professor of Astronomy at the U of I. He's written a lot. He's author of many magazine articles for both popular and things that are maybe a little bit more scientific magazines. He's authored a number of books, and some of them are textbooks, and they're fairly advanced, so they're for astronomers who are very serious hobbyists. Some of the books are for people who are just wanting to learn more about astronomy and don't have that kind of background. And I mentioned a few of the titles. You have a brand new one out.
Yes, right? It's called Stars and Their Spectra, second edition. And it's sort of an introductory level book for people who want to dig a little bit deeper into stellar lives and look at the spectra. When you spread the starlight out into its component colors and you see absorptions produced by various chemical elements, you can tell an enormous amount about the stars, mm-hmm. temperatures, chemical compositions, life histories. Without it, you're lost. Mm-hmm. It's a subject that began to be developed in the early 19th century and has reached a peak in the... It's still peaking, I think, actually. It's sort of looking at the soul of a star.
Uh-huh. So is that essentially how it is that we can look out and recognize that what things are made of?
Yeah.
It's basically the same. It's all the stuff we know that we're familiar with. All the familiar elements that we know.
Same chemical elements you learned in high school. Everything in the periodic table is out there. In the stars, most of them have been identified in stellar spectra, and you can look at the rainbow colors of a star if it's spread out enough, and just even with the eyeball, come up with a rough temperature, quality of the star, state of evolution, you know, where it stands and its life history, and it's amazing what you can learn about it.
Right.
So the book is sort of an introduction to intermediate level astronomy.
All right, very good. And that's Stars and Their Spectra. Oh, that is right here on your bio. It's right there.
Yeah. Second edition.
And if somebody was looking for, say, someone who would just like to learn some about astronomy, but they're just beginning, is there one book that you'd say, well, maybe this one would be a good one?
Little Book of Stars would work.
Okay.
Copernicus, the publishing house.
How fitting.
Yeah.
Copernicus Books. There
a small division of Springer Verlag.
All right. Well, we have some other callers here. Let's talk with them and go to Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm a graduate student at the university in engineering mechanics, and my background in mechanics makes me familiar with, for example, the math and physics that Newton used to prove Kepler's orbital laws, and I find all that stuff fascinating. And I was wondering if your books, or one of your books, might give some insight. I'm just curious about some solar system mechanics. Some questions like, I know one of the planets at least is on an orbit that's, sort of out of the plane of the rest of the planets' orbits, and
that would be Pluto.
Or Pluto, which is, I guess, no longer a planet.
Well, it depends on whom you ask.
Sure, sure. And then, obviously, Kepler said that the planets aren't in circular orbits, they're in elliptical orbits. And I'm just curious, for example, is the plane of the orbit of each of the planets all, relatively and close in agreement? Is there a sort of...
They're all pretty much in the same plane, but there are differences. That's why you rarely see a planet sitting exactly on the path of the sun, the ecliptic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there aren't eclipses every month, because the moon's inclined to the solar path or the Earth's path, not the apparent solar path, by about 5 degrees. So it usually misses the shadow or misses the sun at new moon. And they're all somewhat different. Pluto is kind of wildly different.
Mm-hmm.
Mercury gets up there pretty good, too. But they're all slightly different as a result of accidents of formation and so on, and interactions among the planets over the billions of years.
There's a
brief introduction to the subject again in this ever-changing sky book of mine, but it's a non-mathematical introduction. To get into the mathematics of it, you really need a more advanced book.
I see. What about the say the long axis of these elliptical orbits, do those long axes between all the different planets, do those align, or are they all in different directions?
Oh, no, they're all in different directions. This goes to a set of six numbers called the elements of an orbit, which involve the size of the orbit, the inclination, the orientation of the closest point to the sun, and so on, and they're all different.
I see.
And they're all not only different, they're all slightly variable, too. So the orbits are not totally fixed. They're, for the human eye, they're fixed.
Sure.
To Kepler, they were fixed. But to modern astronomers, you can see how the orbits change over the years. In fact, it's the changes in the Earth's orbit, the eccentricity of the orbit and the tilt and so on that could well be responsible for bringing on ice ages.
So would you recommend one of your books for these sorts of questions, or is there a sort of classic?
Well, if you can find The Ever-Changing Sky, and I think the classic is written by a guy named Smart, and that goes back, I think, to the 30s. And there are a number of it's tough to find an introductory book that doesn't involve the advanced mathematics required to read it. It's really a calculus based subject.
Sure. Well, I can.
Which is one of the reasons Newton invented calculus.
Right. Right. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Great show today. Great topic.
Right, well, thank you. We'll go on and talk next, I believe, with someone in Belgium, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Interesting occurrence last week, and I hope Mr. Inge lets me get slightly off the topic, and I'm sure it has very much to do with your show. I was in central Taiwan, and I went across the Tropic of Cancer, and there's a huge monument there that everybody stops and looks at and has their picture taken.
It's famous. Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is. It's enormous. And the question I want to talk to you about is about the Tropic of Cancer. And another thing that's involved with the Tropic of Cancer is the fact that the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn aren't stationary.
That's right. They're not.
And everybody thinks that this line is where it's supposed to be, but it's not where it's supposed to be.
It's where it was when the monument was built.
Exactly. Because of precession. And the question
is... It's not precession. It's the precession itself is kind of irrelevant. It's the change in the obliquity of the ecliptic. It's the change in the tilt angle between the equator and the orbital path.
Yeah, but
that's decreasing now very slowly. It oscillates by about a degree over, I think, a 43,000 year period, but I may well be wrong in the number.
The way I understood it was moving by about 0.43 seconds a year or something like that?
Something like that.
Yeah.
It oscillates. It'll go down to 23 degrees something and then go back up to 24 and a half or something like that over a very long tens of thousands a year period.
Yeah.
It's a natural oscillation. It's one of the Milankovitch cycles that combined with the eccentricity is thought to bring on ice ages.
The question I had, though, was not precisely to that, but obviously there's that, but we have the great arc that we deal with when you travel back and forth.
Great circle.
Great circle.
Right.
And that deals with a thing called the ROM or something like that?
That I don't know. I'm not familiar with the term.
Oh, I thought it had something to do with keeping the angle of the... It has to do with putting things on a sphere and how you want to keep it perpendicular to it, and it's a spiral that goes around the Earth, so it generates the great arc.
It's a subject, again, in spherical trigonometry, which I used to teach, actually. And... It's not difficult to come up with the formula it involved, but I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to here.
Well, I was reading something about it. It started with the Portuguese to get the circles they could go around the Earth, right?
Yeah, there are various algorithms, I suppose, that you can use to calculate it. I'd have to sit down and do it from the raw spherical trig because I don't know the practical end of navigation.
Yeah.
There's a divide between theoretical navigation and practical navigation, whereas the latter is reduced to a set of formulae that you can easily and quickly calculate, because it's very important to do it quickly, especially if you're on an airplane. You can ask your pilot about that.
Yeah, you want to go where you want to go.
Yeah.
And this movement of this, you say it goes from one extreme to another.
Yeah, it oscillates, I'm trying to remember, by about a degree or so. And this changes the positions of the tropics. It changes the positions. The Arctic Circle is moving north, and the Tropic of Cancer is moving south. And that'll reverse itself.
And that's also opposite direction. If you're in the southern hemisphere, the Tropic of Capricorn
is moving north, and the Antarctic Circle is moving south. It's a natural oscillation, and it doesn't oscillate much, apparently, because if you do the dynamics, this is all pretty much stabilized by the moon. And without the moon, the oscillation is thought to be much greater, as it would be on Mars, for example.
Oh, I see.
The beauty of all of this is that everything affects everything else. Even the planets are affected. It's more a change in the plane of the Earth's orbit than anything else that's causing this.
I see. There sure were a lot of people there getting their picture taken.
I'll bet. But we could have a bumper sticker that the tropics are shrinking, the tropics are shrinking, which they are. We're losing tropics, but we'll get them back eventually.
Thanks
for the question.
Thanks. I'm looking at a picture of this thing, by the way, right now. It's very interesting looking. It's a little kind of puts one in the mind of a flying saucer, actually.
Well, actually, it's kind of like an obelisk but rounded.
Huh. Okay.
You know, it doesn't have a sharp top. It goes up and comes
up. That's half a mile north of the actual tropic now or something like
well,
that.
It's that far off.
It's way off.
Well, there's sure a lot of people there thinking it's there.
We ran into this, my wife and I, when we crossed the Arctic Circle, which wasn't really quite the Arctic Circle. It was close, but it wasn't quite it. It's where it was when the sign was put up.
I see. Well, that's interesting. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and also email will-talk@illinois.edu. In fact, I have an email here, someone who writes in that they're curious about conditions near the center of the galaxy. Is the star density much higher there than it is here? And what would the night sky look like if the solar system were near the center of the galaxy?
Well, it's fabulously more dense. Hmm. That is not actually a scientific number, fabulously. But
okay.
I don't know the star density, but it's tremendously higher than it is here. It's to the point where you probably wouldn't have planets because the stars would interact enough to prevent them from either forming or from developing very far before they were ejected from the system.
Mm-hmm.
You can see stars orbiting the center of the galaxy. It actually seems to be fixed on a supermassive black hole of about 4 million times that of the sun, which is crudely the size of the solar system. And we can measure the mass using Kepler's laws, as developed by Newton, and watching stars go around and from their orbits determine the mass of the central massive black hole. It seems to be sort of the organizing center of the galaxy. And if a star interacts with another star and gets tossed too close, the black hole will tidally shred it, and it'll enter the black hole through a disk in orbit around the black hole, which becomes very bright. So anomalously, the black hole at the center of the galaxy is brilliant in almost all kinds of radiation. It's not the black hole itself. It's the stuff that surrounds it and is circulating around it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the stuff gets set out into jets that you can – and it's fairly active. The systems like this are common in galaxies. They can reach into the billions of solar masses in other galaxies.
One of the things that and it may be just because it would be a popular interest that I've seen a few articles about lately has to do with what are called exoplanets, and I guess what that means is planets we can see that are orbiting other stars.
I've been at the U of I since 64. It's 1964.
Mm-hmm.
People ask, what is the most exciting thing you've ever seen in astronomy in all these years? And one of them, I think, near the top of the list was the discovery of planets orbiting other stars. It has a long and checkered history up until about 15, 20 years ago, the people discovering planets around another star and then undiscovering the planet. But when the technology was there, once we got the technology of looking at the effect that the planet has on the starlight through the spectrum of the star, actually, we're back to the stars and their spectra again, that we began to detect them, and literally they're falling out of the sky. There have been the last time I looked, there were 750 planets note in orbit around other stars. And the Kepler mission, which is looking at transits of planets, will find many, many more. I think there's 1,000 candidates or something.
Yeah, it seems like the number is expected just to keep growing and growing.
Well, it's become whole hum. You know, nobody even looks twice if you find a planet around another star. Big deal. It was very exciting for a while. All the discoveries were recorded. There's an extra solar planet encyclopedia. If you just put that into Google, it'll pop up for you. And there's systems in which as many as five planets have been observed around other stars. And I think even more exciting is that we're beginning to image them. The discoveries of planets have been come from the effect that the planet has on the star, either on the starlight by crossing in front of the star from our perspective, or from the velocity effect that it has on it as the two orbit each other. But there have been several stars now that have been found with where the planets have actually been imaged and seen in orbit. Mm-hmm. Now, we're a long way from finding out what everybody really wants to know. Is there something on those planets other than rock or gas? And well, we're a long way from finding that out, but I think it'll happen eventually.
So even given the fact that it's a long way and we're never going to go there, is it there's some way that we could observe from here?
Well, it all
that.
Comes. It probably comes down to looking at the chemistry of the planetary atmosphere. Mm-hmm. If it's similar to that of Earth, because life processes on Earth dump various chemicals into the Earth's atmosphere, namely methane, among other things. You find methane absorptions in the spectrum of a planet. It might lead you to believe that there might be life. Well, we find methane in Martian atmosphere, but we haven't seen any life. So one of the reasons for the launch of this latest package to Mars is to look for the origin of the darn methane on Mars. It ain't cows.
All right, then. We have a couple of other callers, and we have about 5 minutes, so we'll try to get them both. I think actually someone would like to give us some information about observatory open houses here on line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, just representing the club at the U of I. Professor Kaler's right, first Friday of every month, which actually should be this coming Friday, I think.
I think so.
The rain date is the second Friday of the month. Otherwise, we skip to the following month. And we've got enough personnel on campus now that we've been able to run the open houses year-round through the summer, not just during the academic year. And if you show up to an open house, you can get on our email list to be advised of such things as well. So I just thought I'd pass that information.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet.
So that's great. So and so the observatory we're talking about is on the central campus,
right next to Smith Music Hall.
Right next to Smith Hall
and near Folinger. Don't confuse the big dome on Folinger Auditorium with the little dome on the observatory, which is next to the new biology building up there. Anyway, it's surrounded by bright lights, but you can still see bright stuff through it.
Okay,
Astronomy Club here is a venerable operation. By the way, it goes way back. It was fully functional and operating when I first got here, in fact. One of the older organizations on the campus, a very fine group.
All right, very good. Line two, then. Let's talk with somebody in Champaign.
And we don't want to slight the CU Astronomy Club either, which is also excellent operation.
Very good. All right, yes, caller, line two. Hello.
Yes, I have read that the moon is moving away from the Earth. Would you talk a little bit about that?
It sure is. What happens briefly is that the moon raises tides on the Earth by stretching the Earth out, which is mostly affected in the water, and the Earth drags the tides forward, the tidal bulge forward, and the bulge of the Earth then acts back on the moon, and the moon slows, the gravity of the moon acting on the bulge slows the Earth down, and the slowing of the Earth, the energy involved in the slowing of the Earth goes into the orbit of the moon, which then moves the moon a little bit farther away from the Earth at a pace of about an inch a year.
Will it get to where we can't see it?
No.
Okay.
It will get, and I figured it out once, and I can't remember the number, several million of years hence, it'll get to the point where it's so far away it can't produce a total eclipse of the sun anymore, however.
Yeah.
We're just in a nice era where the angular size of the moon overlaps that of the sun, and you get nice, nifty solar eclipses. The sun will die long before the moon gets so far away it'll disappear.
Wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
This is not just theoretical. This is actually observational because the Apollo astronauts left mirrors on the moon, and you can get the distance of the moon to well within an inch through lasers running through telescopes
so
and bouncing
it off
the moon
how long
and measuring
it takes
the
to
delay.
Get
it's radar with light.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, it's pretty much as theoretically predicted. The moon is, in fact, is slightly getting farther away from the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing that the thing is 250,000 miles away. It can measure the distance to an inch.
Pretty good. On this question of life on other planets, I'm thinking also. I came across an article saying there's someone who is suggesting that, and this may indeed be limited by the kind of telescope technology we have, but suggesting that with a powerful enough telescope, you would be able to detect artificial light sources on another planet. So if you had, say, if you had a good enough telescope, even if you were a long way away from the Earth, you could see Tokyo. I think the idea was if there actually was
you'd
a big city, you could actually see
it. You'd have to resolve the image of a Earth-like planet, which in current technology is utterly impossible.
Hmm.
I've never calculated the angular size of a planet. It's easy enough to do. I just can't remember what it would be. But it would be, I mean, a nickel on the moon would be big compared to it, I think. So
is it actually, can you imagine such a thing being possible? It's just a matter of figuring out how you do it?
Given the galloping forwardness of the technology used to discover planets, it'd take a monstrous telescope to do it, because telescopes are self-limiting in how the angular sizes of which you can see. If you got a big enough one, theoretically, it'd be possible. It'd be fun to calculate how big your telescope would be required.
Mm-hmm.
And what other technologies might come along. People have looked, there's the search for extraterrestrial radio sources, because the Earth is radio bright. It's kind of sobering to think that there's almost a 100 light year wide bubble of howdy doody shows going off out there. we'd be readily detectable through systems that we could produce on Earth, but if some extraterrestrial had them. We haven't found anything, but people have actually looked also for laser lights coming from other planets. Mm-hmm. You couldn't spot where it would be coming from. They're just looking for stars that would have lasers around them. Nothing's been found so far. You'd have read about it in the papers.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop there for the moment with our thanks to Jim Kaler. He's Emeritus Professor of Astronomy here at the U of I. You can go out and look for his books at the library, the bookstore. The newest one is Stars and Their Spectra. You might also look at the Little Book of Stars. You think that might be good for...
That's a good intro book, yeah.
Introduction. Also, he has two websites, Skylights. That'll tell you what you can see from week to week in the sky, and also Stars, which features the star of the week. What's the star of the week this week?
I can never remember. I'm working on the one three or four down the line.
All right. You can go there and you can see the star of the week. Jim Kaler, hey, thanks very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.